Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vocat. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. On July 30th, the new smoke-free housing rule from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development went into effect, protecting residents of federally funded public housing units throughout the state of Connecticut from secondhand smoke. So we're going to reach out to a representative from the American Lung Association to learn more about the new rule and how it addresses the serious health threat posed by secondhand smoke. Then we're going to meet the organizer of the upcoming All Sounds Fair Music Festival, which showcases some of the region's top LGBTQ artists, and check in with the executive director of the New Haven Pride Center, which will be the recipient of proceeds from this unique music event coming up on September 9th to the Space Ballroom. Then we're going to close hearing about some exciting news for many state residents diagnosed with numerous types of breast cancer, as we ring up a researcher and physician from Starling Physicians Group who will discuss how thousands of Connecticut residents diagnosed with breast cancer could avoid the risks and side effects of chemotherapy as they undergo treatment. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vocat, right after this reminder. August is almost over, but August is National Immunization Awareness Month. So this month, the health departments across Connecticut join the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and other health officials to celebrate the benefits of vaccines and highlight their importance for people of all ages, including school-aged children who need back-to-school vaccines, pregnant women who can protect themselves and pass protection onto their babies. Also, babies and young children, because a healthy start begins with on-time vaccination. Preteens and teens, who can ensure a healthy future with vaccines, and adults, because vaccines aren't just for kids. You want more information? Just visit the National Public Health Information Coalition. That's nphic.org/NIAM. We've done a lot of segments on this program, certainly about smoking and its dangers, smoking cessation, numerous programs involving organizations or entire communities or populations on the danger of secondhand smoke. Today we're going to talk about what was once a suggestion that is now a policy. Over the last decade or so, HUD has encouraged both public housing authorities and multifamily housing owners to establish smoke-free communities and has even issued a toolkit to aid in that process. But now, with its final rule published, HUD is mandating for the first time that public housing authorities go smoke-free to improve indoor air quality, benefit the health of public housing residents and PHA staff, housing authority staff, I should say, and reduce the risk of fires, as well as lowering overall maintenance cost. So no later than August 3rd, just a few days ago, all public housing communities had to implement a policy that barred the use of prohibited tobacco products in all public housing units, interior common areas, and outdoor areas within 25 feet of public housing and administrative office buildings. So with that rule now in place, we are going to find out from the source, one of our great resources at the American Lung Association, about the implications of this new policy, as well as a couple of other important things that you need to know about secondhand smoke. And the best person to go to is our friend Ruth Canovi. She is the Connecticut Director of Public Policy for the American Lung Association. Ruth, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So that introduction was pretty much the gist of it. What was once a friendly suggestion, maybe a little finger wagging, is now essentially gonna happen, or by now has to have happened.
It's happened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So with the fact that the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development smoke-free housing rule is in effect, let's break it down to the basic level and talk about why the American Lung Association, and I imagine you, are so pleased with this recent development with all these public housing institutions, not just across Connecticut, but around the country.
Yeah, no, thank you again for having this opportunity to talk about this important rule. I think really, I mean, following, we're we're really celebrating this long-awaited health protection, right? I mean, following more than a decade of advocacy for the passage of this rule, as well as support of the implementation of smoke-free housing policies, even in local public authorities, we're excited that we can really have some opportunities to protect residents of federally funded public housing units, not only through the state of Connecticut, but throughout the country from the dangers of secondhand smoke. I mean, I don't think it's any surprise to anyone that secondhand smoke is not something that's good for us. But really, in specifically talking about in apartments or multi-unit housing, I mean, tobacco smoke can travel anywhere there's an opening in walls that air can get through, right? So it can travel from room to room, unit to unit, through doors, windows, plumbing, electrical outlets, crawl spaces, attics. So really, there's no way to eliminate the risk of secondhand smoke from people who are in these living spaces. And I can't tell you the number of times I've gotten phone calls from people who've said, so I've been waiting to get into this housing, and now, you know, my husband has emphysema, and I don't know what to do about this because our neighbors are smoking, and we're really concerned about his health. So this is an exciting time where we can really feel good about protecting people from the dangers of secondhand smoke.
Well, from the scientific perspective and all the research and all the knowledge that the American Lung Association has, secondhand smoke exposure and the effects of it really can't be minimized. People say, oh, well, you know, a couple of times a day I walk out of my office or I walk out of my building and I'm walking through a cloud of people smoking, you know, right beyond the limit line, you know, right where they're supposed to be, but I still can't get to my car if I don't walk through these people. So a couple times a day, I'm sure I'm getting exposed to it. And then you have people like that tenant that you mentioned who's, you know, whether it's through the vents, under the door, when they go out in the hall to take out their trash or go out to their vehicle, they're constantly, essentially 24 hours a day, they're in proximity to secondhand smoke. Talk a little bit about the differences in the implication in that exposure. I mean, it has been shown, I guess, that people that even have limited exposure to secondhand smoke do have a amplified risk, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Surgeon General came out with a report that said there's no safe level of exposure to secondhand smoke. In fact, they say the scientific evidence is now indisputable. Secondhand smoke is not a mere annoyance. It is a serious health hazard that can lead to disease and premature death. There's no safe level of exposure. And the EPA also actually, the Environmental Protection Agency classifies environmental tobacco smoke or secondhand smoke as a carcinogen, a cancer-causing chemical. So we're really concerned about exposure, especially, you know, in homes, people are spending their days there, they're sleeping there, and are, you know, don't get a lot of say if this is their option for housing. And so we want to ensure that people are protected from exposure.
Yeah, because I guess even if you're like in a unit next to somebody who smokes and you can open your window, if their windows are open, it's going to come in your open window. So there's no fresh air or no complete access to fresh air, even if you're disabled, say wheelchair bound, you can't leave the room and you just sit by the window, you're still getting it. I just wanted to flip one of the later points that we were going to touch upon to kind of clarify now the role that the Lung Association has played in the advocacy and history of this and other similar policies.
So I mean, I think since the 60s, when the Surgeon General started talking about this, the Lung Association has really been advocating for protecting people's lungs and health, right? And so we were instrumental in working on prohibiting smoking on planes when that was an issue, or even looking at when and where advertisements can be made, because we know that youth are so susceptible to those kinds of messages, trying to prohibit advertising for cigarettes or other tobacco products on television. In 2003 in Connecticut, they passed the Clean Indoor Air Law, and that was something that the Lung Association worked hard with partners to ensure that people, and especially like we talk about residents, so people in their home, but also workers in restaurants and bars. That was a time when people were exposed to a lot of secondhand smoke, right? And so that was a huge impetus for really moving the bar on that piece, because we wanted to ensure that people weren't exposed to this really dangerous secondhand smoke at such an intense level.
Yeah, I guess the cliche of the smoke-filled room never comes into such crisp focus as it does on hugely popular programs like Mad Men,
right?
So many of these others that kind of flash back to the 60s, 70s, even 80s, where it's like when you think of the environment today, even in movie theaters and restaurants, or even outside of movie theaters and restaurants where smokers still gather. I mean, when you look at the clarity of the air in so many environments today versus what it was even a couple of decades ago, I mean, there was a massive, massive amount of smoke.
Oh, yeah.
And even if people were diehard non-smokers, they were secondhand smoking a couple of packs a day in some cases, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Well, let's Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so the Lung Association is pretty proud of the work that we've been able to do and really moving the bar in terms of limiting the exposure of secondhand smoke to folks. So this is just one additional step and something that we're really excited about and proud of.
Great. Well, we should tell folks, whether they're smokers or not, that we are talking with Ruth Canovi. She's the Connecticut Director for Public Policy for the American Lung Association. We're talking about the fact that just a few days ago, a rule went into effect with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development that essentially eliminates smoking in and around all of HUD-related facilities around the country. Let's talk about some of the specifics of those rules, Ruth, that folks might be interested in knowing, or if they live in one of these complexes and haven't really somehow gotten the message yet, then they'll be aware of it.
Yeah. So the rule prohibits the use of lit tobacco products and hookahs inside all indoor areas and 25 feet from all federally funded public housing authority buildings. And so that's kind of the extent of it. I've actually been talking to a number of housing authorities because one of the things that they are concentrating on is trying to ensure that people who are addicted to this kind of have the resources that are available to them. I mean, they can go outside, but also if they want to quit, there are resources available to help people quit this. And so I can let you know about some of those as well. I was thinking about that.
Sure.
And so there's a quit line that the state, and it's in most states, it's 1-800-QUIT-NOW. You can call and talk to folks about quitting and get some counseling and things like that. Those are available. And the Lung Association also has a helpline. That's 1-800-LUNG-USA spelled out. And so, and that's for if people want to help quitting, but also if they've got questions about anything regarding lung health. And so those are two resources for folks. And so I've been working with the public housing authorities to try to get the word out to people who are impacted by this and know that there are resources available. Because they want to ensure that, because we acknowledge that cigarette smoking or tobacco is an addiction, and it can be a really challenging one to quit. And so we're trying to ensure that people know about the resources available.
Yep.
And looking at that information, we also know that I think generally at most times about 70% of smokers actually want to quit. So we want to ensure that people know about those resources available.
Sure. And for folks who never smoked and maybe don't even know anybody that smokes, or, who may say, well, okay, what's in it for me? I mean, we can't undersell the public health cost that smoking wreaks on states like Connecticut, because even if you've never smoked and you don't know anybody that smoked and you don't imagine you ever will, you are still reaching into your pocket virtually every day and paying taxes that in some way, shape, or form flow through the system and supplement care, prevention, intervention, sometimes at massive expense for people who have smoking-related illnesses.
Yeah. I mean, if we look at the numbers have been crunched, and the annual health care costs in Connecticut directly caused by smoking are $2.03 billion, and Medicaid costs caused by smoking in Connecticut are $520.8 million. So that's extensive. And so if we're looking at that economic piece, it really does have a huge economic toll, never mind the health toll and the loss of lives toll as well.
One of the ways that the industry, so to speak, has sort of begun to really strongly kind of flip away from burning tobacco has been e-cigarettes and smokeless, yeah, so to speak, products and devices. Let's talk about how e-cigarettes fit into the HUD smoke-free policy.
Yeah, and so right now the HUD smoke-free policy is just lit tobacco products and hookahs, but essentially the American Lung Association's stance on e-cigarettes is that they're tobacco products and they should be regulated as such. And so we will be working on that in Connecticut with the clean indoor air laws that exist. The e-cigarettes have been implemented to most of those laws. There's one exemption where in Connecticut, there's all kinds of places that you can't use tobacco products, and e-cigarettes are almost the same except for general workplaces. It specifies out restaurants and bars and things like that, but in the indoor laws regarding cigarettes and lit tobacco products, it is also included any workplace with fewer than five employees. Or with more than five employees, yes. And that is not the case for electronic cigarettes.
So what's the plan for the next session of the legislature in terms of the work that you're going to be gearing up for, Ruth, in terms of e-cigarettes?
Yeah, so, I mean, in general, there's two priorities, I would say, for us right now. And one of the things that you mentioned was funding, you know, what the state pays in regards to tobacco prevention. And one thing that happened last session that we're really very concerned about is the fact that, a little history, there's something called the Tobacco and Health Trust Fund.
Oh, yeah, we've talked about that, yeah, very recently on this, right, program a number of times. It's ridiculous. It may almost not be designated to smoking and smoking-related initiatives. I mean, it's just, right, this ton of money that's coming into the state and going everywhere but where it's intended to go.
Yes, and so that's actually in that kind of last-minute budget that passed this year. We saw essentially that funding for the Tobacco and Health Trust Fund has been eliminated indefinitely. Hmm. And so we're very concerned about that because we see the tobacco industry spending more than $70 million a year in Connecticut on marketing. And when we're looking at these e-cigarettes and how popular they are among youth especially, we're very concerned about we've made such great progress in regards to, like, the number of youth or even general cigarette smoking rates. But e-cigarettes are becoming so popular that we really need to do something about getting the word out that these are not safe water vapor things that we're imbibing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're tobacco products. Kids are getting addicted to nicotine who normally would never go down the route of smoking a cigarette. And they're more likely to now be using cigarettes once they start using electronic cigarettes. So we're very concerned about that, and so we want to see some funding to get good information and education out to youth and their parents about the dangers of these products. And right now, we're on schedule to spend zero on that aspect of things in Connecticut, which is just uncomprehensible to me.
Sure.
The other thing that a lot of people are looking at is increasing the age of tobacco sales from 18 to 21. Gets the tobacco products out of high schools. And right now there's estimated that 56,000 kids in Connecticut will die prematurely because of their tobacco nicotine addictions. And so
sounds like your work is
there's
cut
a
off
lot of evidence, yeah, that if they start later, we can do some good work there.
Excellent. Well, a lot more to learn about the initiative, which all starts by visiting lung.org, L-U-N-G.org, for the American Lung Association. You can key into the work that Connecticut is doing, and in particular, some of the work that Ruth Canovey is doing. She's the Connecticut Director for Public Policy, and she has been our Ruth for the morning here on the award-winning For the People. So, Ruth, thank you so much for this great information, and we're going to probably come back around and talk to you a little bit more as things start to develop with some disturbing issues with the current administration in Washington proposing to revoke some cleaner car standards, and probably catch up on how you've honed your strategy for the upcoming legislation to try to maybe reel some dollars back out of that zero-sum pool from the tobacco settlement. So we'll be back and talk to you again at some point before the session. But thanks for being with us this morning. Well, it's great to make new friends here, especially when they're involved in grassroots initiatives that have the potential of touching and helping the lives of a lot of people here in Connecticut. And I'm so pleased to make the acquaintance of my next guest, Alex Wetmore. She is the founder of an organization called All Sounds Fair, and they're holding their third annual, the Connecticut All Sounds Fair. Is a music catalyst for LGBTQ causes, and its mission is to band together for human rights and advance equality through the power of music. And they're working with sponsor Concord Media Group to bring a show to the Space Ballroom down in Fairfield County on the afternoon of September 9th. So without further ado, let's meet Alex. Alex, great to finally get you on the air. We've chatted a few times offline, and very excited to actually hear some of the backstory of how this all came together a few years ago.
Well, hi, John. Thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be here and talk All Sounds Fair. All things All Sounds Fair.
Yes. So tell me, how did this whole crazy wheel get rolling?
So a couple of years ago, back actually 2014, I said, you know what, there are not enough music concerts featuring LGBTQ artists or festivals that honor these artists, and I wanted to do my part to change that, so I literally held a concert in my friend's backyard. Now we see them popping up, which is great, in Nashville on the West Coast, but I thought there really isn't an East Coast representative of that, so that's how it started, in my friend's backyard, and nicely, yearly, starting in 2016, we've put on these music benefits for a variety of LGBTQ nonprofits.
Mm-hmm. So how do you go about deciding who's going to be the beneficiary?
I did a lot of research probably 2015, 2016, and I just looked into a lot of the nonprofits, some big, some small, who needed help. For example, we went to North Carolina during the HB2, which was the whole transgender bathroom real problem, and we went there and held a benefit for a small nonprofit called Transcend Charlotte and raised money for people there. But then I really wanted to bring it back to my hometown. So I've been living in Connecticut for over 10 years, and I thought there's so many great nonprofits here. Why can't I do something right here to help? So then one year I sponsored Out CT's Pride in the Park. The following year I sponsored Triangle Community Center in Fairfield, their Pride in the Park. And then I was introduced to Patrick Dunn, who you'll speak to in a little bit, and I've been learning more about the New Haven Pride Center and all they're doing for LGBTQ youth and transgender population, and I'm like, it's a logical fit.
Excellent. So you've done you and your team, other folks who come to the organization either around the time of the benefit or throughout the year. You're kind of been in event management, so this is not a thing that just came out of the clear blue sky and came off well in that first backyard effort. You did have a little bit of a foundation going into this.
I did. You know, I think I still have that 16-year-old girl's dream of being a musician, and it just never worked out. So I have nicely a lot of friends who are musicians, plus the majority of my career has been spent in PR and marketing. So between that network system and my background, somehow it seemed to come together, and really it's been the power of networking, which has been so helpful. And, you know, I'm a member of the LGBTQ population, and I'm raising, as a non-biological mom, two amazing daughters who are 11 years old. And I really wanted to do my part, especially in the latest political climate, to make a change for them and for the future.
Fantastic. Well, tell us about the event and before we take a break, and then dial up Patrick and find out how this event and all the folks that hopefully are going to come out and support it is going to end up benefiting.
Great. So on Sunday, September 9th, from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m., so it's an afternoon show, at Space Ballroom in Hamden, we're featuring a great band from, it's really a musical duo from Brooklyn, New York, by the name of Tomboy, who really have been heating up the airwaves there and getting a lot of press. And I've liked them for a few years, and I'm like, how can I do something for them? They're going to be headlining our benefit show for New Haven Pride. And then we're opening with a great local act, this woman by the name of Laura Clapp from Guilford, who's fantastic, and she and I actually used to work together. So she'll be, it's going to be a great mix of music for a Sunday afternoon after Labor Day. That's going to be a lot of fun.
Excellent. So,
tickets are $15, and the proceeds go to New Haven Pride Center.
Mm-hmm. And anything else going on tied to that event? A lot of times these things have like silent auctions or food or beverage, or is this just basically show up, make your donation of that $15 ticket charge and go in and enjoy the music, like a little mid to late afternoon concert, and then everybody goes home?
That's pretty much it, but I have a few things up my sleeve that I hope are going to come together in the next week or two that might be a fun promotional idea with another New Haven business, hint, a brewery. So
very good.
See.
Super. And tell us a little bit about the partners and your support network there. This isn't an event that can come off on its own.
No, and honestly, I couldn't do any of these events with the great sponsors that I've really pulled through. So Concord Music out of L.A. has just been a wonderful, really proponent of my cause and mission. And then most recently, Connoisseur Media, and that's how I was introduced to you, have just stepped up and been wonderful support systems. So no, I could not do it without the help of some wonderful people and organizations.
Excellent. Well, we want to just remind folks that may have tuned in during the conversation that we're talking with Alex Wetmore. She's the founder of All Sounds Fair, which is a grassroots and groundbreaking way to engage and enlist the LGBTQ community's help, along with its straight allies, to provide high-quality entertainment to promote equality. Their big event is coming up at the Space Ballroom, as you're hearing, on September 9th. The doors open at 1:30 and the show starts at 2. And if you'd like to learn more about this organization, you can go to allsoundsfair.org and get all the necessary information to find out if this is something you'd like to be involved in or support yourself. We're going to hang up from you now, Alex, and take a quick break. And then we're going to come back and talk to Patrick and find out about how the proceeds from this year's All Sounds Fair event are going to help benefit the community. So thank you so much for taking some time with us this morning. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through LoveCT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click onto LoveCT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The American Red Cross in Connecticut, as well as Cigna Corporation and the Hartford Fire Department, are joining together to offer free smoke alarm installations to residents in Hartford on Tuesday, September 11th between 9 and 2. This Sound the Alarm, Save a Life smoke alarm installation event is part of the Red Cross Home Fire Campaign to reduce the number of home fire deaths and injuries, and the Red Cross is hoping to install 500 free smoke alarms as part of this event. In addition to providing free smoke alarm installations and education, the Red Cross is also looking for volunteers to help install smoke alarms for this event in their community throughout the year. If you'd like more information and to get involved, just visit redcross.org/CT. All right. Well, if you are sticking with us through the break, you've already met Alex Wetmore from All Sounds Fair. And as we heard, her upcoming benefit on September 9th is going to benefit the New Haven Pride Center. So as Alex alluded earlier in the chat, we're happy to have Patrick Dunn on the line with us now. He's executive director of the New Haven Pride Center. So, hey, Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It means a lot.
So the New Haven Pride Center, as we kind of talked about before we picked up the microphone, used to be called the New Haven Gay and Lesbian Community Center. You guys have been guests on this program going way back to the former handle on the organization. So tell us a little bit about what New Haven Pride Center is today.
Sure. So the New Haven Pride Center is one of two LGBTQ plus community centers in the entire state of Connecticut. The other one is the Triangle Community Center in Norwalk. And in addition to being a community center, which means that we kind of have the makeup of all of the typical community center things, we have public space that people utilize within the community for meetings and gatherings. We offer a variety of support groups and social programming. We're also the only gallery space in the entire state of Connecticut specifically dedicated to LGBTQ plus visual artists. And we're one of the producing partners of Pride New Haven, which is what the All Sounds Fair concert will be benefiting. So we're kind of a gathering place of all things LGBTQ plus.
a post concert march from the space the venue of the concert into downtown New Haven would be something.
Yeah. I mean, the concert's going to be at the Space Ballroom in Hamden.
Hamden, right?
So far away. But yeah, we are doing a march during Pride on the Saturday of Pride New Haven this year, which is Saturday the 15th, and it will leave from the New Haven Pride Center and go kind of around downtown and end at our block party, which is kind of the big public street festival that we do as part of Pride. And so we will still have that kind of visual impact of that kind of march in the kind of traditional LGBTQ movement, queer civil rights movement, iconic image, if you will.
Your organization, being one of only two community centers for the LGBTQ community in the state of Connecticut, you are nowhere near New Haven centric in terms of your following and the folks that you draw. I imagine you see folks coming, if not to directly participate as artists themselves, to come down and socialize and patronize the programs that you're doing from all over Connecticut, or perhaps even beyond.
Definitely. So we our reach as the New Haven Pride Center is very broad. We have clients and members and supporters from all over the state of Connecticut, and we have people that come as far as Rhode Island, New York, and Massachusetts to come to some of our support groups and social programs, particularly for our social programs and support groups around the transgender community. We're kind of a major hub for the transgender community, both in Connecticut and kind of a little bit further beyond our borders. when you're talking about Pride and the reach that we have, you know, Pride New Haven is the largest Pride festival in Connecticut in the context of how many events that take place. We this year are going to be going for 7 days, including the concert that we're doing in partnership with All Sounds Fair. So that makes us definitely the longest festival. We have about 16 events taking place in that 7 day period. We employ about, last year we employed about 125 artists, because we do pay all of the participants who perform during Pride. It's something that's been, kind of a point of pride for us that we've always been doing that. And, you know, these artists are coming from all over the state. Probably about 50% of them are greater New Haven area, but the other 50% are from all over Connecticut. We have a couple artists coming in from New York, one coming from Jersey, and we get several artists from Western Mass every year and one or two from Rhode Island. So we really are, have a pretty broad reach. And then when you're talking about numbers of attendees, you know, that's in the thousands, especially now that the Pride New Haven has gotten so big in length wise. You know, the block party itself has usually between 2,000 and 3,000 attendees throughout the kind of 6 hour period. So it's really awesome. And all of this happens because of community partnership. Mm. You know, the New Haven Pride Center is just one of the producing partners of Pride New Haven. Pride New Haven was originally founded by Gotham City Entertainment and Rob Bart, who's the owner of that, and was really funded by Rob and Gotham for about 15 years until the New Haven Pride Center started to get more involved as a producing partner. And now it's very collaborative, and we have a committee of community members that act as chairs and really help direct the vision. So it's you know, built for the community by the community, which is vital. And I think vital to why we've been so successful.
Well, also to kind of take the focus up to 10,000 feet, you're kind of in a great state for the cause because, you know, you have a very receptive political leadership in Hartford, starting right at the top with Governor Malloy and Lieutenant Governor Wyman. So I imagine in some respects, it's a little bit easier to kind of get this momentum going and keep it going and growing here in Connecticut than I imagine you're hearing from your colleagues and counterparts that have similar efforts that are going on in other parts of the country.
You know, it's really interesting there. You know, I think there's a lot of misconception around kind of the LGBTQ right community, the LGBTQ plus community here in Connecticut, compared to the national community. I mean, we face the same challenges. Yes, we live in a very politically positive state, and we live in a state that has extremely strong protective laws. But we also live in a state where gay panic and trans panic defenses in the courtroom are legal defenses to things, acts like murder and hate crime. So, you know, there are definitely challenges that we still face in the state. And one of the greatest challenges that we face, both as Pride New Haven, but as the New Haven Pride Center, funding is extremely challenging in the state of Connecticut because neither at the state level or in the foundation community is LGBTQ considered a minority group. So we don't show up when you're checking off minority communities you serve. We don't show up. You know, and then when you start looking at demographics, the LGBTQ community is completely erased from kind of grants and or other reporting structures when you're talking about how, you know, what is the diversity of your organization? LGBTQ isn't even on there. And let alone, you know, things like the trans community are completely left off because you're filling out boxes that say either male or female. And it's, you know, so there are kind of a lot of unique challenges. But the flip of that is that we also have incredibly supportive people and organizations and community leaders, including, you know, the city in New Haven. Our mayor is very supportive of both the Pride Center and Pride New Haven. She always makes it a point to attend events. And before her, the same was true about the previous mayor. He came to every Pride Festival. He was responsible for the original money that was set aside so that the center could be founded, 22 years ago. He arranged for us to have free rent for a year, which is the only reason we were able to survive that first year. So, you know, there's a lot of positivity, but I think that because there's so much positivity, sometimes the kind of underground negativity that a lot of our community members experience gets lost or hidden in all that positive energy. So I like to point out that there's still challenges.
Sure, sure. Well, I hope that folks that are listening that want to learn more about the role that they can play, LGBTQ or straight, to help the efforts that are not succeeding as quickly, and I also understand there's quite a challenge because, you know, say in terms of you know, getting grants and qualifying for certain benefits, a lot of these things are coming from national organizations where it's much more challenging, but hopefully there's some folks that'll come together as a result of hearing you on the program this morning and maybe help. Maybe they have some political leadership or wherewithal that they can lend to the cause. I would ask them to visit newhavenpridecenter.org to learn more about this organization and to get all the backstory on the Pride Festival that's coming up. And don't forget, opening day of that is this All Sounds Fair benefit happening at the Space Ballroom in Hamden. That's on September 9th, and the entire event kicks off at 2 p.m. Our guests this morning have been Alex Wetmore, the founder of All Sounds Fair and the promoter of the September 9th benefit at the Space, and Patrick Dunn of New Haven Pride Center. He's executive director of that organization. Once again, if you want to find out more about All Sounds Fair and pick up tickets or head out to this event on September 9th, their website is allsoundsfair.org. Patrick, I look forward to speaking with you again because it sounds like we got a lot more to talk about and a lot more fire to put under the folks.
Yeah, I would love to have you back anytime.
Very good. Well, I'm going to wait until you get this big event out behind you because I know it's a massive amount of work to put together a week-long plus event. Planning probably starts the day after the last event ended, but we'll hopefully have you back before the end of the year to talk a little bit more deeply about putting folks' energy towards some of the work that needs to be done. So thank you so much for being on the show. So recent research has found that patients with the most common type of breast cancer can safely avoid treatment with chemotherapy. This is has major implications in treating folks with breast cancer and in their treatment plans. And I'm so pleased to make the acquaintance of and welcome Dr. Daniel Morgenstern, a leading breast cancer subspecialist with Starling Physicians. He's joining us today to tell us how this new research will affect women here in Connecticut. So, Dr. Morgenstern, thanks for joining us on the program and for all the pre-production assistance that you help provide. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Before we turned on the microphone, you indicated that you just sort of recently came to Connecticut from Boston.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be with you, John. I just joined the excellent group at Starling Physicians after practicing for about 14 years at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, dedicated to the care of women with breast cancer, and also recently had co-founded a project on an emphasis on breast cancer prevention, something that I'm also very enthusiastic about. There are more and more opportunities to prevent this dreadful disease, and something we should all take advantage of.
Mm-hmm. Did you always start out, did you start out as a with a goal as a practitioner and then got into research, or were you always sort of had a foundation in research?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Oncology, maybe in particular breast oncology, is one where clinical care and research are almost hand in hand. Many of our guideline groups say that part of excellence in treatment is access to clinical trials. So frequently they do go hand in hand. They go hand in hand within our practice here, and of course at major cancer institutes. So most because there are occasionally imperfect answers for cancer. Most people have some amount of their time dedicated to improvement of outcomes through clinical research.
We're hearing so much more across the fields of cancer research and treatment about the incredible work that's being done through the utilization of DNA and genetics and in crafting what is starting to become almost an individualized type of care plan and treatment. Tell us a little bit about your role in this and a little bit about how you're able to articulate this to the patients that you're treating.
Yeah, so that really is the sort of revolution in oncology. I mean, there was a time that all we really factored into a patient's treatment plan was where the cancer started out or where the cancer presents itself. And with the tools that you referenced, ability to evaluate cancers at the genomic or DNA level, we've learned that at times cancers that are seemingly unrelated in unrelated parts of the body have many similarities. For example, there is a type of stomach cancer that responds to a antibody that has been for 15 years the mainstay of treatment of breast cancer. So we're learning that the vulnerabilities of cancers cross boundaries within the body, and that that analysis of the tumor at the DNA or RNA level frequently will dictate choices in treatment. And while we used to think of breast cancer as one disease, we certainly think of it now as at minimum five diseases based on receptor status and so forth. And that type of individuation is ever increasing, and that seems to always work to the benefit of patients, because when we do that, we find out treatments that have enhanced likelihood of benefit, and then we also cross off our list medications that may be causing undue toxicity without the added benefits. So that's really the theme. You know, there had been a period in breast cancer and in many other cancers where it was sort of a building or an adding on of therapies. Let's add A and B to our cocktail of C and then see if that's better. And so there was this escalation of treatments. And then if you think about one of the paradigmatic cancers where we've seen this historically, Hodgkin's disease, we got the cure rate up so high from Hodgkin's disease that we then began to ask, how can we minimize the late-term side effects? So instead of increasing the intensity of therapies, the last 2 decades have been spent in that disease, figuring out how low can we go, how much can we delete from the regimen and still get the both the good immediate cure rates, but also minimize the long-term liabilities. And that's really the phase that breast cancer medicine has recently entered, and with this recent research development over the summer, has really sort of got us a good deal farther in that regard.
Yeah, let's dig into that, because, you know, as a cancer survivor myself, I was in that position where I had to kind of work with my team to determine whether or not for the throat cancer issue that I had, whether it was going to be radiation, chemo, or radiation and chemo. And in some cases, I found myself weighing, man, is the cure you know, going to be worse than the disease? So this breakthrough in chemotherapy treatment perhaps the need to not utilize it must be pretty exciting for you.
It really is, and it's a tremendous win for the population of women diagnosed with this disease. So, I mean, just to set the background, you know, this research applies to the most common type of breast cancer, which is called estrogen receptor positive and lymph node negative, meaning not spread to the axillary lymph nodes under the arm. You know, historically, we knew that with this type of breast cancer after surgery in early stage patients, that use of a hormone blocker alone would result in about 15% of patients, unfortunately, having the disease recur over the next decade in a life-threatening manner. And our historic approach to that was just simply to treat everyone with chemotherapy because we knew that that further reduced the risk. But the 85% of people that were exposed to the drug really gained absolutely no benefit from it because they were cured by the hormone therapy alone. Mm-hmm. And so we needed to better sift out who really needs it and who doesn't. So along came this assay called the Oncotype Recurrence Score, seemed to be pretty good at predicting use of the benefits from chemotherapy, but was never subjected to our gold standard, which is a randomized controlled trial where, say, 50% of the people are assigned one path and 50% of the people are assigned another. Now, within this trial, which is probably the biggest breast cancer trial ever conducted in this day and age where superlatives are used maybe all too frequently, this is one where it really applies. In a group of about 7,000 women who had this special genetic test of their tumor and came out with what we call an intermediate score, where the benefit of chemotherapy is historically been uncertain, they were randomly assigned to either receive preventative chemotherapy first, followed by a hormone blocker, or to just receive a hormone blocker. And with long-term follow-up in this study reported this year at the American Society of Clinical Oncology and recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine, what we found at a long-term follow-up was that precisely 5% of patients, both with or without chemotherapy, had these life-threatening relapses. And that the chemotherapy really didn't add anything, with the exception of women who were younger, under the age of 50, and some other sort of refined points. But for the vast majority of people with this group that we had historically given chemotherapy, we're realizing that the hormone therapy alone will be not only sufficient therapy, but also spare the toxicities, both short-term and long-term, of chemotherapy.
So the stats I'm looking at are today, this year, we're going to see well in excess of a quarter million, mostly women, diagnosed with breast cancer. How much of that annual population could potentially be spared chemotherapy?
Again, the stage of diagnosis has a little bit to do with it, but, you know, rough estimates might be that this applies to somewhere around close to half of that population.
Wow.
Perhaps a little bit less because of some eligibility criteria of the trial where patients with large tumors were ineligible for this approach. And patients with lymph node positive tumors were ineligible for this approach. But again, this is really again what we call de-escalation of therapy, where we kind of understand the tumor on a molecular basis and can sort of winnow out who are the sort of credible threats and who are the patients who are going to do just fine with therapy that has minimal impact to their day-to-day quality of life.
Very good. Well, are there any other new findings that are going to affect breast cancer treatments that you're following?
So there's really a lot. One of the therapeutics that has me very excited is something called a whole set of medicines, which are called drug antibody conjugates. So these are antibodies made in the lab that attack cancer cells, but they're sort of a chemotherapy molecule is attached to them. And these combination medicines hone specifically to cancer cells, attached to the surface of the cancer cells. The cancer cell eats them, so to speak, endocytosis, we call it. And so it's something that specifically delivers the chemotherapy to the cancer cells and to a great extent limits the exposure of the rest of the body. to those chemotherapy drugs. So that's a very promising area. We have one drug approved in that class for breast cancer, and I think a number of other drugs similar to this are likely on the cusp of approval for areas of breast cancer that still have unmet needs, such as triple-negative breast cancer, a more aggressive type of breast cancer. I would just like to make one point and circle back to something I hinted in the beginning, which is that there are lots of opportunities for women to lower their risk of this disease, many of them simply lifestyle things, many of them identifying people who are at genetic risk. And also, it's not well appreciated, but many people are candidates for medications that reduce the risk of breast cancer. So a lot more can be done in that area. We're very enthusiastic about decreasing the rate of breast cancer, and I think together we can all do that with some opportunities that we have.
Very good. Well, folks can learn more about you and your team by going to starlingphysicians.com/cancercare. And we thank you for joining us and really opening our eyes about this exciting new information that's coming through to help people potentially avoid chemotherapy as part of their breast cancer treatment. So thanks for being on the line with us this morning. We look forward to talking with you more about it as time progresses and new research starts to develop in this industry. Thank you, Doctor. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for airtime in writing to me via email at john.voket, that's john.voket, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast without permission of Connoisseur Media. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voket. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and important information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.